Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is course two on my 2020 book, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined. I'm Knut Swamholm, and I'm here, as always, with Luke DeWolf. Good morning, Luke. How are you today?
Good morning, Knut. I'm doing great and excited to be finally kicking this off with the first chapter of this book, Fiction and Reality. This is going to be a fun one.
It sure is. Yeah, a lot of things have happened since I wrote this. So let's just dive into it, shall we, and see what my brain conjured up back in 2019 when I wrote this.
Let's do it. And just as a reminder, if you want to get involved with the show, with the Academy, you can join our Bitcoin Infinity Academy group. All the details are on our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity. All the details are there. I won't take any more time. Let's dive right in. So I shall read the first paragraph, right, Knut?
Yes, you shall. Be my guest.
Yes.
Or be my co-host rather than guest.
Thank you. Fiction and reality. Humans are unlike other animals. Our ability to cooperate on massive scales certainly seems to be a skill other apes or mammals lack. What is the unique mental tool that makes us capable of doing this? Our closest evolutionary relatives, chimps, baboons, and other monkeys, show similarities to humans when it comes to forming hierarchical societies. But none of their packs or tribes ever grow larger than a few hundred individuals. Why is that? It has something to do with our collective imagination. We've observed chimpanzees constructing altars for worship, dancing rain dances, and grooming their dead, but they are yet to be seen pilgriming by the millions from all continents to kiss a wall. They trade fruit and present offerings to their patriarchs and matriarchs, but they aren't yet trading government bonds for fiat currency. We humans, on the other hand, have conquered the world with our ability to rally under a common flag. World religions, spiritual movements, nation-states, and even multinational corporations have provided human beings with the motivational tools necessary to take control of the earth and dominate all other forms of life, even though the concept of a nation, a religion, or a company are all just social constructs of human imagination at their core. We humans tend to perceive our collective imaginations to be just as real as the ground we walk on, the foods we eat, or the air we breathe. Okay, Knut, what are you getting at?
Yes, I'm getting at that all of these societal things that we take for granted and we see as just as real as a rock or a table or a car are really just figments of our imagination and constructs of our imagination. And we, by taking them to be as real as objects in our objective reality, we can interact with each other in ways we couldn't have if we didn't have the ability to do that. It's a long and convoluted way of saying what the paragraph is saying, basically. But there's something here. Dunbar's number can be mentioned. The reason that the chimps and the bonobos and whatnot do not form flocks bigger than a few hundred individuals is probably because of Dunbar's number, because that's the maximum amount of other individuals that you can hold in your memory, so people that you can know simultaneously on any form of deeper level. So the reason that humans can form bigger entities than that, or scale, if you want, is that we can rally around these collective fantasies or intersubjective ideas, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty big proponent of this sort of thing, and I mean, there are theories that this is part of how humanity started to. It's a feedback loop, right? It's one of the things that stimulated the brain development, which resulted in going towards things that created human evolution in a certain way, right? And I think the whole idea of that stories and collective myth and things like that bring people together and these constructs, I think it's absolutely true. It's a form of how we organize the world around us without having to literally know everything about the world. You take the territory of the world down to a map of understanding, basically. And the map can never be the entire territory, otherwise it would be the entire territory. In other words,
yeah.
To simplify that, you can't literally know objectively everything about the world. So you make a mental model of that. And those mental models are these stories, these abstractions, even metaphors that we use when speaking. Yeah, I fully agree. I think this is building up to something. Do you have any other thoughts here?
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is the Dawkinsian notion of genes and memes and how they're similar in their evolution. So an idea survives because it survives, just like a gene survives because it survives. And that can be because it's adaptable. It can be because it's strong. But sometimes bad ideas evolve too and survive. And like that big fat fish that eats nothing but jellyfish and is completely stupid and can't do shit, like that survived too. So like, and then those ideas, the memes, they shape our genes. So, and vice versa. So the ideas in the human brain actually shape what human beings become in the future. And even more so what dogs become, for like dog breeding is a human idea and it has completely changed the evolution of the dog. So, and I think we do that to ourselves too, to a certain extent, even if it's not as deliberate. But ideas certainly shape reality on the individual level, but also on these grand scales where it actually influences our evolutionary journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, I think the merger of these two ideas, like kind of where we come from on this, like I take more of the inspiration from Jordan Peterson and all this, but I think they're both entirely right. And well, I want to see what this is building up to. So shall I go on to the next paragraph?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's explore.
This ability to lie to ourselves at scale is arguably our biggest weakness as well as our greatest strength. We've somehow managed to conquer the world while concurrently setting a trap for ourselves that we have already fallen into. Blindly following our leaders has rendered us under-equipped to detect when we're being used. We've been domesticated. If the idea of domestication bothers you, you need to free yourself from your leash. This might be harder than you think, and you'll soon realize that you're tied to more than one of them. So is everyone else. Not listening to religious lunatics might be easy, but not buying into the idea of the nation-state, or even democracy, is a stretch too far for most people. When you really think about it, though, borders, laws, institutions, and ultimately money are as intangible as Zeus, Thor, or Sauron. Only our common agreement of their existence makes them exist. Unlike trees, cows, or garbanzo beans, they could not exist outside of our minds. The fictitious nature of money, in particular, is vastly misunderstood. Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws, Mayor Amschel Rothschild allegedly said. At the very top of each nation's food chain sits the entity controlling our money, the lifeblood of every society. Garbanzo beans aren't real, Knut. What do you mean?
What even is a garbanzo bean? I've forgotten. Oh, the thing I would change here if I wrote this now is like I would substitute the word money for currency. Because currency, I believe, requires this collective fantasy, whereas money does not. Money is based... I'm a true believer in commodity money. I don't think money ever came into existence as people owing other people stuff, because you need something to owe the other person. Like the commodity is the thing, and a currency is like a perverted form of a receipt for money. So a receipt for gold, for instance, and if someone can print more of them, it's not an actual commodity anymore, and not even a representation of it. It's fraud, and it's a figment of our imagination. And as we talk about in almost every episode of this and in almost every chapter of the book, money being conjured out of thin air, or currency being conjured out of thin air, is the root cause of most of the problems we see in the world today.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And well, I enjoy this paragraph for a couple of reasons. The reference to Mr. Rothschild, or I prefer to use the pronunciation Rothschild, the German, because it actually gets to the origin. They had a red crest, so it literally means red shield. And so that's apparently the origins of that name. But the thing about the religious leaders, though, and this is interesting, we've been having some conversations that really dig into this point. And Jeff Booth, in our latest conversation, made actually a really interesting point, is that many of the religious leaders that are actually kind of these more prophetic types, I guess, they seem to have gotten something about money. Like, you're not supposed to actually do usury, or you're not supposed to do all of this money changing stuff. And that was interesting. The thing I think is the problem. It's not the religious ideas themselves. It's the power structures that form around them, right? Because somehow these ideas actually get the correct thing, that you're not supposed to do this money control stuff. But it's the power structures that come after them that introduce it later.
Yeah, and I think this is like part of why I use the word religious leaders rather than prophets or something else, because that's a different thing. And there's a very good Rothbard book called A History of Economic Thought that explains, like, science before the Enlightenment was basically religious figures, all of it. Like, they were Christian thinkers. And a lot of them had a lot of good ideas, even better ideas than the people after the Enlightenment, especially the economists, because they tied this to, like, their question to themselves was always, what would God have wanted? Which is, in many cases, closer to something like a more ethical way of doing science from a certain perspective, I'd say. And I've changed my mind quite a bit on that, on like the history of religious thought, because it has not always been about imaginary friends, but also other subjects. And the subject of money is that a subject that many of the religious thinkers of the past were actually way better at than their post-Enlightenment counterparts. So, yeah, there's something there. The thing they got wrong, though, that is seldom mentioned, is that they thought all, like, usury and interest were muffled together. So a lot of them were thought that interest in itself was sinful or bad, which you cannot really make any good arguments for. Interest is just to harken back to Jeff Booth, it's the price of tomorrow. That's what interest is. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But there is something inherently wrong when that is fake or counterfeited, or like loans conjured up within there. That's where they should have been. And that's why I fell in love with the Austrian school, because the Austrian thinkers are so eloquent at describing exactly that and what's wrong with it.
Well, and I think one add-on point here for this is that, like, this is maybe back to the idea of the idea doesn't have to be entirely correct. It just has to be useful enough to make a difference. And I think it's that kind of thing. Like, if they couldn't really fully get around that, you know, it's actually the debasement and the inflation and things like that, that's the problem. That making the rule that says, okay, well, no interest, no usury, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe that has actually the effect of kind of putting a cap on the problem, right? Like, the oil is spilling out into the ocean, but they've got a pretty decent plug that, so it's only leaking out a little bit, you know?
Exactly. And that's why I think today that Arabic banking is better than Western banking in a lot of senses, because they still have this ban on interest. They get around it in different ways, but so it's also bad, but it's bad in different ways. Yeah, these are like proto ideas, and they're very interesting to study.
What's funny, I mean, they basically just do everything with fees instead of interest. You have to just pay a certain fee for the loan.
It's more like just as bad, but still, there's something to this. These ideas survived for a reason, and I think that this might be an underrated aspect of why Christianity had such a, or still has such a longevity spanning 2,000 years, because it didn't permit counterfeiting. That might be a very good evolutionary trait to have.
Right. Well, but then they eventually broke that, and ironically enough, the Rothschilds were basically able to flourish because they were willing to do the usury when the Christians weren't willing to do it. So basically, you would go to your Jewish purveyor of banking services instead to get your loan, because the Christians wouldn't. And that's basically one of the things that allowed such an accumulation of money and resources. So there actually isn't anything like dark or sinister at the end of the noticing rabbit hole. It's just these funny ideas, right? So
yeah, absolutely. And of course, the mind goes to a whipped a whip with knots tied on it that Jesus used to whip the usury merchants into submission in some temple. And therefore, the name Bitcoin Knots for Luke Dasher's wonderful project here to save Bitcoin from illicit use.
Well. Should we move on?
We should.
Back to the book. So, what can you do about this? And why would you want to do anything about it in the first place? You may have a perfectly fine life right now, with a steady income and many career opportunities. So why bother questioning everything? If we look at certain statistics presented by the likes of Hans Rosling and Steven Pinker, it becomes abundantly clear that the denizens of Mother Earth are doing better and better every year. While the claims of Rosling and Pinker may be somewhat truthful from certain points of view, they fail to address the long-term problems inherent in our fiat currency systems. They fail to address that if we continue business as usual, we are all doomed. Not because of climate change, nuclear war, or any other red herring, but because of the horrifying Orwellian dystopia that will be the inevitable outcome of our current pandemic monetary cancer. You may not be aware of it, but your country's currency is on the exact same path as that of the Venezuelan bolivar or the Turkish lira. The only thing that differentiates them is the pace of the decline. The compound interest of a 2% inflation per year currency will sooner or later follow the same hockey stick to hell curve as any other hyperinflating monetary paper money. Not only this, but as physical cash becomes more rare, your financial affairs get more surveilled. Your banker overlords are monitoring you, mapping you out, and categorizing you according to your financial behaviors. To them, you're just a piece on a board game that they wrote the rules for. As long as you stay in the conventional systems, there's nothing you can do about it. Your vote won't matter. You're not in control of your destiny, not by a long shot. But you could be if you found another way. If you found a way to store the fruits of your labor in a sort of monetary freezer that made sure that the number representing the work carried out was representing the same amount of work or more when you defrosted it again. A cold storage of wealth. A piece of a specific pie. A piece of Bitcoin. I'm sure we tried to find a paragraph break in there when we were re-editing this, but we did not. That was a long one.
Yeah, this book has long paragraphs. Yeah.
Bitcoin, that's the answer, right?
Yes, that's a TLDR on all of my books. I can mention Steven Pinker. He wrote a book called Enlightenment Now, and I can really recommend Hans Hermann Hoppe's takedown or breakdown of that book, because it's a great book. I liked it when I read it. This is like 10 years back. It's pointing out how much better everything is today than it was before, and how we've almost eliminated like starvation and really deep poverty from the earth, and everyone has a smartphone in their pockets, even in rural Africa, and so on and so forth. Everything is, for the most part, better. And he claims that this is due to the Enlightenment and due to democracies being more and more popular around the earth. But the counter argument to that is that he says that the main point is that the world is not at all as violent as it used to be. There aren't as many wars or civil wars or stuff like that. People don't die from being hit upon the head as much as they used to. What he leaves out is that everyone's under threat because everyone's paying taxes and everyone's paying extra taxes through inflation. So we are, you know, hostages of war, all of us, in a sense. It's not entirely peaceful as long as you're still forced to do shit rather than other shit. So that's the part of that book that Pinker's just completely blind to. What do you think?
I think here that this is exactly right, and it really is the combination of the Pinker thesis plus the Booth thesis need to be conjoined, right? Like, You take that we actually should be in a deflationary state because the world is getting vastly better despite the money printing, right? It's crazy. Like the world is in fact getting better, and the doomers and the perpetually online and the perpetually tuned into cable TV people just don't get that because it's an endless doomer loop. I mean, I've been actually avoiding Twitter lately in favor of Noster, just because the doomerism there is just so ridiculous. And on Noster, at least there's some arguments, but it's not so bad. Like on Twitter, it's just like everything is falling apart. The world is falling apart. On mainstream media organizations, newspaper, TV especially, it's just everything is bad. Everything is falling apart. But the world has gotten objectively better. Almost everyone in the entire world is better off than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, something like this. The Western world, yeah, okay, you can definitely make the argument that things are worse by some metrics, so especially after the COVID pandemic, right? But you know, you have a much faster phone in your pocket than 10 years ago, you know what I mean? You have the artificial intelligence, you have all of this stuff. All of these innovations that keep happening, and the prices keep going towards zero because deflation is actually the natural state of things. So can you imagine just fixing the money printing, and then wouldn't everything just like rocket ship? Like as we have hyper Bitcoinization, we're also going to have hyper prosperity, hyper
prosperization.
Yeah. Hyper prosperization.
Hyper prosperization. Yeah, that's exactly what it is, because like technological progress and political degradation are the two forces, and they're going in the opposite direction. So and the political degradation of everything has to happen because the technological progress is getting faster and faster, turning sand into mobile phones. So and in order to keep up the illusion of stable prices, the decline of politics has to go faster and faster every day to just keep up. Because prices really ought to go down, and if you denominate in Bitcoin, you see it. It's that simple. So it's such a beautiful solution. It's such an underrated and underexplored solution. And like everyone who's lived in Bitcoin and with Bitcoin for the last 10 years knows exactly what this feels like. It's a fantastic feeling, and it's sort of unbelievable. When I grew up, there was a show on the public service media television called the Boy with the Golden Pants. And this was about a 10-year-old boy who suddenly realized that he could conjure up more and more monetary bills from his pants. He never ran out of them. So he could like buy more and more shit. And of course, there was a socialist undertone to it that he didn't get happy because of this and everything went to shit or something. But Bitcoin actually is those golden pants. Like if you use it properly and you use number go up technology properly and just wait long enough, your purchasing power will outpace the whatever you're paying for stuff, which is like perpetual money machine at this point, at least we're in the adoption phase. And there's a lot left of the adoption phase. Like even when all the 8.5 billion people of the world have Bitcoin, there is still more money to be funneled into it. Like, and after that, you just have the free market on steroids without interventionism. And it's like so much better. Yeah, I can go on and on, can't I?
Well, I think let's continue with the actual points here, but it's just awesome. And I think that's quite the deep cut. Bitcoin is the golden pants. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, so the sense morale here is never don't slay the golden goose for a Kinder egg.
Right. Yeah. I have heard that before.
Yeah. You.
All right, let's continue. Is money real or just another human collective hallucination? Well, a gold coin is real in the sense that it exists and that it's made up of gold atoms. Its value, on the other hand, isn't real. It can't be. Value is, contrary to what most people believe, an entirely subjective thing. There is no inherent value to any object. Value is a human creation that we imbue to objects or services. What makes a gold coin valuable to a person is that person's belief that gold will stay valuable to a lot of other people. Value is determined by the importance an acting individual places on a good for the achievement of his desired ends. It is pure speculation, and so is everything else in economics. If you buy a bottle of water, you do so because you think that its contents will satisfy one of your basic needs, probably thirst, at some point in the future, namely when you open the bottle to drink it. What makes a gold coin valuable to a great number of people is the perceived scarcity of the metal. Making jewelry out of gold doesn't give gold its value. Jewelry is made out of gold because jewelers believe they can profit from the metal's perceived value. Value, while being subjective, can still be said to be derived from supply and demand. We think we know that gold is a rare metal, but is it? No single human can ever truly know, but there's enough verifiable data for us to believe that the global supply of gold is somewhat limited. It is this believed scarcity of the supply of a good in conjunction with the belief that there will be a future demand for it that makes humans attach a value to a good or commodity. Because dollar bills were once redeemable for $1 worth of gold at a bank, people still think that dollars are connected to gold somehow, or, at the very least, that they are somewhat scarce. Spoiler alert, they aren't. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is verifiably scarce by anyone running a full node in the Bitcoin network. This feature alone makes Bitcoin a far better form of money than all of its predecessors. Yeah, very good educational paragraph. Value.
I mean, this maybe if I wrote this now, I wouldn't have used the word real, but objective instead, or something, or tangible, because a human evaluation of something is very much real because it manifests into the real world. I like the Hoppian argument that action is actually the bridge between the subjective and the objective. So that's philosophically that's what happens. Like, human beings feel uneasy. Somewhat uneasy, they imagine a state of the future in which they have done something, used means to reach a certain end, and they believe that they will be more uneasy when they've reached that end. That's why human beings do shit. That's the very basics of praxeology. And this manifests in action, which is actually the subjective evaluations of human beings manifesting in objective reality. This is how we interact with reality and how the subjective and the objective are bridged, if you wish.
Yeah, very good. And I think the tying at the end here to Bitcoin and the running a node and everything like that here, I mean, I don't think we have to pull into any kind of current level of debate about what kind of full node you should be running. You should just be running a node, and ultimately, you should be verifying that your Bitcoins are actually Bitcoins, basically, that your sats are real sats. But the ability to do that is just great. I mean, I've seen posts on the gold subreddit, for example, that people are all like, is this gold bar real based on the markings on it? And or like, here's the results of melting down this like nugget of gold that I have. And it's just like, it's so much effort to actually verify gold, right? You literally expend energy that you have to pay for it. You have to pay for a node too, but it's so much simpler. And it's just math and it's great.
Yeah, and I mean, this goes so deep. I explore this in chapter 2 of Everything Divided, in the alchemy chapter about element zero. But there's so much here. Like, the only reason that you can act as if you owned a certain Satoshi or a Bitcoin or a certain amount in a UTXO is that you believe that the likelihood that someone else has access to the same private key as you do is so infinitesimally small that you can act as if you owned it. But at the end of the day, it's just information and you can't own information. The really weird part about that is that if you zoom into Planck lengths and stuff and the quantum mechanics levels, this is true for gold too, because gold is made out of atoms, which is made out of even smaller particles that are random in nature. They don't become what they become until you measure them. So like, the universe is probabilistic at its core. This is a weird shit, I know, but what makes Bitcoin as real as any tangible metal or object in reality is just that we can act as if we own the thing, because the properties it has enables that. The same with owning a gold bar, then you have it in your physical possession and you can guard it with machine guns or whatever, or dog. With Bitcoin, memorizing a seed phrase or knowing the location of a private key is a different way of doing the same thing. They lead to the same result. They lead to you being able to say that you own something.
Excellent. Should we continue?
Yes, sure.
Money laws, nation-states, religions, and other constructs of the human imagination are not entirely subjective beliefs, nor are they objective facts. They are not entirely subjective because their existence is not limited to the brain of a single individual. A better, more suitable description would be that they're intersubjective, meaning that they exist in the collective consciousness of a large group of individuals. Because of this, ideas like that of money, or that of an almighty God for that matter, do not die because of the death of a single believer in that particular idea. Ideas live on until they're destroyed by force, or until a better or more saleable idea comes along, rendering the old idea obsolete. Whatever spirit gods the natives of Cuba believed in, for instance, disappeared when the European conquerors murdered every tribe that inhabited the island. The idea of alchemy, on the other hand, became obsolete with the rise of chemistry, which rendered the idea of alchemy somewhat ridiculous in hindsight. This very text is only able to convey its message because of the intersubjective idea of the English language, without which the words written would be little more than undecipherable scribblings of a madman. Our current dominant monetary systems are intersubjective ideas based around the full faith and credit of Nation X's central bank. They are very powerful short-term and can help infrastructure reforms at a fast pace. But they do so at the expense of future generations, who have massive debts, authoritarian regimes, hyperinflation, and possibly civil wars to look forward to because of these flawed systems. Bitcoin doesn't need an intersubjective belief other than that miners will continue to act in their own best self-interest. Therefore, its promise of a finite supply is more of an objective fact than an intersubjective fiction. Its functionality and finite supply are at all times verifiable by the network's users. The only other intersubjective belief needed in order for the system to thrive is the belief that people will continue to discover its superior monetary properties. Properties that cannot be reproduced, since Bitcoin is so much more than the sum of its parts. Its code, its developers, its node runners, its surrounding software, and first and foremost, its history makes it a truly unique beast. Okay, I think just building on the ideas we've been talking about mostly.
Yeah, exactly. Here, the miners will act in their old self-interest part. Yeah, it's also that the node runners will act in their own self-interest. That is what makes the miners, what forces the miners to act in their own self-interest in a way. And everyone else in the system, developers too, like no one's safe from the free market and the node runners. That's what drives the Bitcoin's incentive structure and the game theory behind it, makes it so beautiful. Yeah, I think the paragraph is largely self-explanatory. What do you say, Luke?
Yeah, somewhat. I think another thing here is that Bitcoin, if one actor within Bitcoin drops off, it doesn't, you need to kill everyone who has any connection to Bitcoin in order to kill Bitcoin. And I think that's the thing. That's the reason why anyone who says Bitcoin is going to go to zero is just stupid. Like they don't understand that it's the valuation of Bitcoin is because someone wants to hold Bitcoin and Bitcoin is valuable to them. Now, okay, could it happen that the Bitcoin network collapses so catastrophically that it's really not worth anything to anyone anymore and people stop buying it? Maybe, but it's also probably that some part of the network is still going to function enough that there will be hardcore Bitcoiners around who still want to continue with the project. But Bitcoin going to zero, I believe that's one of the closest things to impossible in the world.
Yeah, probably. I mean, people are still buying things that are provably not finite at all, like NFTs and shitcoins. And they still have some value, even though its value goes down slowly. Like, blockchains don't completely die. They sort of fizzle out. So Bitcoin going to zero is almost close to zero chance of that happening.
Absolutely. Shall we finish this off? I think this will be the last paragraph.
Yes.
All right. If the system continues to function as it has for the last 11 years, hyperbitcoinization will happen. It is inevitable. The only uncertainty about the transition to a Bitcoin-denominated world is the time frame. We cannot know how long it will take for the fiat currencies to die, but it probably won't happen within the next couple of decades. After all, the idea that Bitcoin challenges is arguably the most successful intersubjective idea that ever existed. The idea of a global reserve fiat currency. It is an idea that cements the planet's current power structures and hierarchies and keeps populations in check. It won't be easy to persuade people that everything they thought they knew about money, banks, jobs, income, taxes, laws, and even democracy was based on a lie, and that this lie has now been exposed. In truth, just about the only thing that can persuade people to switch to Bitcoin is the number that goes up over time, the price of Bitcoin. A limited supply doesn't automatically mean unlimited demand. And it is important to remember that Bitcoin is still being issued at a faster rate than gold and most fiat currencies right now. At the time of writing, the halving from 12.5 to 6.25 new Bitcoin mined per block is about 5 months away. Don't forget that we're still in Bitcoin's early history and that a lot of volatility is still to be expected for any foreseeable future. Okay. Hyper-Bitcoinization. Go.
The thing that comes to mind is one thing I mentioned in the last paragraph about the English language. And this is a pretty recent theory that I have, that hyper-Bitcoinization looks a lot like the adoption of English after the introduction of the internet. You have, like, I was traveling around 20, 25 years ago in Europe, and almost no one in like the Eastern European countries spoke any English. The French and the Germans and the Spanish were still pretty shit at English. Like, English skills in general were pretty poor until the internet happened. And now every kid speaks fluent English. Like, and that just happened. I think Bitcoin adoption has a similar adoption curve thingy. The internet is here, and it speaks Bitcoin. So will its users, given enough time. And the younger generations have never seen, have never been in a world where Bitcoin didn't exist. So it's just a matter of time.
Absolutely. Love that idea. And I think a few things here. So obviously we're at another whole halving level, and I believe it's correct now that it is, that we are in fact being issued slower than gold now.
Yeah.
Stock to flow is lower than gold.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, 3.75. That means below 2%.
Yeah.
So it's lower than gold. The thing, yeah, when you see the numbers, 12.5 to 6.25, it's like the first feeling you get is like, holy shit, this is written two halvings ago. Like, time passes fast. And 12.5 is a lot more than 3.125 or 175.
125.
125. Yeah, sorry. It's just insane. And if we saw, what's it called? The time chain calendar is a very good visualization of Bitcoin and the time chain. There you can see on a circle, like how many Bitcoins that are issued. And it's above 96%. So when you see that, it's like closer to, if you imagine that as a clock, it's closer to, it's like 3 minutes to 12 or something. That's how many Bitcoins there are left to mine. All the others are already out there. So yeah, it's truly insane how real this upcoming sat squeeze is. And if you're not on board the train, you don't get to experience it.
I love it. I think we should just end it right there. I think this has been a interesting chapter. Lots of stuff about kind of the idea of ideas, basically, and value and all this.
Yeah, this book doesn't hold back. Like, it goes straight into quite deep stuff. So I'm looking forward to the rest of it.
Absolutely. Well, okay. I think with that, now all that's left is to just give a shout out to our wonderful sponsors, starting with Plan B Network. If you haven't checked them out, go to planb.network and you can see all of the wonderful educational resources that they have about Bitcoin. That's their mission: make Bitcoin educational accessible to just about everyone. And when I say that, I mean that the goal is to translate all of the materials they have, build more courses. It's really a framework and a platform, and we're thrilled to be part of it. Anything else you want to say about Plan B, Knut?
Yeah, we're going to the Plan B Forum in Lugano later this October, in 25th and 26th, I believe it is. And that's a great conference. I urge you all to who have the chance to get over there and see some great Bitcoin content. And it's a lovely town, or it's somewhere between a city and a town, I guess. I'd call it more of a town, actually. A very cozy and very beautiful. Lugano is great. And they are expanding. I saw some new stuff going on in Taiwan. And I know there's a lot of stuff going on in El Salvador, of course, where there's the Plan B Forum San Salvador in January. Probably going to that one too. We'll see. Yeah, a lot of things. And we love that collaboration, and we want to do a lot more with Plan B. Also, our favorite hardware wallet are sponsoring the Academy too, the Bitbox. So they have a new version of the Bitbox out called the O2 Nova. Isn't that right, Luke?
Yes, absolutely. And the biggest thing about the Nova is that now they support iOS. So basically, you can use it directly with your iPhone or your iPad or whatever iPhone device you want, which is great, more accessible for more people. You, of course, can still use it on your PC, your Android phone, whatever you like. And they've made some other upgrades, tempered glass, so it's more scratch resistant now, and also a new secure element. So really, I think they said that they thought about calling it the Bitbox 03, but really under the hood, most of the things are the same, but they've made some upgrades. So yeah, it's the Bitbox 02 Nova. So check that out, bitbox.swiss/infinity, and you can get our discount code that way. You get 5% off. So go check out the Bitbox 02 Nova and be sure to get the Bitcoin-only firmware.
Yes, and finally, make sure you like, subscribe, and brush your teeth. And the subscription part is important because this channel also hosts the Bitcoin Infinity Show, where we have great guests every week, very interesting voices, mostly from the Bitcoin space, or almost only from the Bitcoin space that we talk to. There are two more episodes coming up from the... Or maybe one more episode when this is released, come to think of it, from BTC Hell, where we did some live interviews, and we have a great lineup this fall. So make sure you don't miss an episode of the Bitcoin Infinity Show. And also, if you're not there already, join our free Telegram group. There's links in the description, I guess, of this video. So yeah, that's what I have.
Perfect. All right. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.